I was there once. I was one of them. And now he's on the other side and he's receiving that. But he knew that as he was receiving it, he wasn't very good company, wasn't he? And in fact, you see, in Acts chapter 23, in verse 1, it says, and Paul earnestly beholding the council. You see, he'd been brought before the Sanhedrin. But that's exactly what had happened to Stephen, because in Acts chapter 6, we're told, in verse 9, Acts 6 verse 12 says, and they stirred up the people and the elders and the scribes and came upon him and caught him and brought him to the council. And that's exactly where Saul finds himself on the occasion of Acts 23 verse 1. Paul, earnestly beholding the council, said, men and brethren, I've lived in all good conscience before God unto this day. And he finds himself in the same spot. Do you know that I believe that Saul was probably a member of the Sanhedrin? If you come to Acts chapter, let me find the right place for this. If you come to Acts chapter 26 and verse 10, it says this. Acts 26 verse 10, which thing I also did in Jerusalem, and many of the saints did I shut up in prison, having received authority from the chief priests, and when they were put to death, I gave my voice against them. You see the word voice in that verse? The actual word in the Greek is psephos. P-S-E-P-H-O-S. Psephos. You know what psephos means?
Vote.
Sorry?
Vote.
Yes, vote is very close. What are you reading from there, Grant? Okay, it's very close. It actually means, literally, a pebble. But you see, the pebble was used to cast a ballot or a vote in the box of the Sanhedrin. And they would probably have a white or a black pebble. Black meant guilty, white meant innocent, and that's how the Sanhedrin voted. So when it says of Paul that when they were put to death, I gave my ballot against them, I wonder whether that's an indication that in fact Saul was a member of the Sanhedrin. He'd been there, he'd been part of that council. So when it says in Acts chapter 23 verse 1, and Paul earnestly beholding the council, he looked out on the sea of faces, and guess what? He knew a lot of them, knew them all, knew the high priest, knew all those Pharisees looking at him. But now he's on the other side. Now he's on Stephen's side of the ledger, and making defence for the truth. Now let me show you something interesting at the end of the story. This is the opening 10 years, as it were, of Saul's labours. He was converted approximately AD 36. You want to know when he died? You want to know when Saul died? Converted about AD 36. Does anyone know when Saul or Paul died? The answer is approximately. Let me just show you a chart, by the way, to see if any of you have got this one. Have any of you seen that chart there? The Acts of the Apostles? If you haven't got that and you can track one down, it's a good one to get hold of because it schedules the chronology of the New Testament, at least as far as Saul's concerned or Paul is concerned. It slots all the epistles in and it takes us through the Acts of the Apostles. And he was converted about the year AD 36 and he died, we believe, in the year AD 68, 2 years before the overthrow of the Jewish Commonwealth in AD 70. Where was he slain? Anyone know? Where was Saul slain? Where did he lose his life? Not Jerusalem, but Rome. Just outside Rome. Now, what was his job? What was his apostleship? Christ says, I will send thee far off to the Gentiles. And this is almost symbolic to me that what happens is that he starts off his life in the land and with his first great defence perhaps in Jerusalem, and he ends up on the far side of the world in Rome, which represented the capital of the Gentile world, didn't it? Rome represented the capital of the Gentile dominion of the days, and he ends up his life in Rome. I will send thee far off to the Gentiles indeed, and that's where he ends. Now, do you know, before he died, he wrote his last letter. to a young man whom he loved dearly as his son in the faith. It's the last recorded epistle that we ever have written by Paul. Now, who is the man? And what's the last chapter of that letter? Anybody know? So what's the last letter that Paul ever wrote? You're thinking of, I think, the second epistle of John. Actually, no, I see what you're saying. Sister's son. That's Mark, who's sister's son to Barnabas, is that right? It's not Barnabas or it's not Mark, but it is another young man. Who's the other young man? Yes? It's Timothy, and it's 2 Timothy. It's the last letter he ever wrote. Come and have a look at this. I just find this very emotional. The second epistle of Timothy, we believe, is the very last letter that Paul ever wrote. By the way, he was imprisoned in Rome twice, wasn't he? He got imprisoned. He got released. He left. He went round the ecclesias again. He went back to Jerusalem. He did some more preaching work. And finally, he ended up back in Rome again. But this time, he wasn't going to escape. Not the second time. The second imprisonment of Paul in Rome, he was not going to escape from. And he obviously knew that because he says in verse 6 of the 2 of Timothy 4, now 2 Timothy 4 is the last chapter, and 2 Epistle of Timothy is the last book, so this is the last chapter of the last book that he will ever write in his life. And he says this, verse 6 of 2 Timothy 4, I'm now ready to be offered. The time of my departure is at hand. I have fought a good fight, I have finished my course, I have kept the faith. Henceforth there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give me that day, and not to me only, but to all them that love his appearing. So I think he knew that the end was coming. He wasn't going to escape this time. The Roman authorities had him, and they were not going to release him this time. No, the end was on its way. And in that letter, when he knew that he's about to die, he says this in verse 14. Alexander the coppersmith did me much evil. The Lord reward him according to his works, of whom be thou ware also, for he hath greatly withstood our words. At my first answer, he says, no man stood with me, but all men forsook me. And then he says this, I pray God that it might not be laid to their charge. Now, where did he get that from? Where did Saul get those words from? Those are the dying words of Stephen in Acts chapter 7, aren't they? I pray God, Acts chapter 7, verse 60. Lord, lay not this sin to their charge. And now Saul has come to the end of his life. Look, this is about 30 years later. This is about 30 years later. But even though it's 30 years ago since he came to the truth, and 30 years ago since Stephen was persecuted to death, he'd never forgotten that moment. He'd lived all his life to try and fill that void as best as he could. It was his own journey of atonement, you see, before God, that he had consented to the death of that righteous man. And so now at the end of his life, he says, I pray God that it might not be laid to their charge. And I think that when Saul used those words, when Paul used those words in 2 Timothy 4, I think he was doing this to Stephen, wasn't he? It was his last salute to Stephen. I've never forgotten you, he says. And I pray to meet you in the kingdom. You know, there's going to be lots of interesting meetings in the kingdom out there. And this is going to be a good one. Can you just imagine the day when Stephen meets Paul and finds that although he thought he'd lost his life in the truth, Stephen, that life, that death in the truth had brought forth the fruit of one of the mightiest men that would ever walk the earth and preach the truth. And that as a result of Paul being there on the day that he, Stephen, died, is that this whole multitude of Gentiles, including us right here today, are there on that day, all because of Paul. Because we're only here because of Paul. We're only here because Paul preached the truth to the Gentiles. It never would have come to us otherwise. So we're all linked to Stephen as well. Oh yes, it'll be a great day in the kingdom when we see that meeting and know that God can put all things right that have ever seemed to be wrong in this present mortal life. So this is the story of the conversion of Saul. It shows us that any of us can be changed by the power of the truth. And as long as we're prepared to be humbled, to be led by the hand, to ask God what to do, to enter into prayer, to accept the washing of baptism, and the whatever God and Christ sends us to do, that we take up that with the very best of our ability to be sent forth on whatever work we're sent. And to remember that if we're to do that work well, that we've got to disappear off to Arabia for a short moment to prepare ourselves. If we've learnt all of those things, then we will have gained from the story of the conversion of Saul. Now you might not think this, in fact you might think this is a strange thing for me to say. But do you know that I'm fine standing in front of a group of even 500 people giving a lecture in a public town hall. But when you put me in front of one person that I don't know very well, I need my wife's hand to hold on to because I get a bit shy. And you might be surprised to know that even speakers can come from strange places and be a bit uncertain of the synagogue or the council they're facing on that occasion. So I'd like to thank you for your time and your attention, because I have felt very warm and comfortable here, even though you might not have known that. You've all been great in terms of your attention and your quietness, and I love the tables here so that you can take notes and put things in your margin, and I'm so grateful you've had opportunity to do that. I think it's been a really happy Bible school, and I'm thankful for the fact that I've been allowed to come here and spend time with you. And I hope that together we've profited out of this story. And I hope that you all go forth and you go home, and that sometime in the future your family looks at your bedroom and says, "What's this word Arabia on the door?" You say, "Never mind. That's for me to know and for you to worry about." Thank you.